July 1937, the world's most famous woman pilot disappears during her attempt to circumnavigate the globe. In 1988, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, a small nonprofit known by its acronym TIGER, began a science-based investigation of the Earhart disappearance. Decades of forensic research and a dozen South Pacific expeditions have now produced hard evidence from multiple disciplines to provide the long-sought answer to the riddle. In this series of conversations with Joan Sachs, TIGER Executive Director Rick Gillespie takes us step by step through the adventures, the setbacks, and the discoveries that uncover the evidence that has solved aviation history's greatest mystery.
Hi, I'm Joan Sachs. Like many of you, I've read newspaper and magazine articles and watched television documentaries about TIGER's adventures and discoveries. As a member of TIGER, I've participated in research, and I know there's so much more to the story that's never been told. I've known Rick Gillespie and his wife, TIGER co-founder Pat Thrasher, for many years, and so when Rick asked me to help him bring the behind-the-scenes story of TIGER's Earhart expeditions to the public, I enthusiastically agreed. Over the years, there have been 12 TIGER expeditions to the South Pacific, and we've organized the podcast into 12 seasons. The episodes in season one tell the story of the first trip in 1989. Season two deals with the next expedition in 1991, and so on. To follow the progress of the investigation, you'll want to listen to the episodes and seasons in order. For newcomers, we make it easy to catch up with the story so far by publishing a compilation at the end of each season.
And this is a compilation of the two episodes in season three, the 1996 expedition.
Hi, Rick. So we are about to begin our third season of the Earhart expeditions. I'm wondering if you can give us a wrap-up of where we were so far when we left off.
Yeah. So it's 1992. We've just concluded our second expedition to the island, and we're convinced that we've solved the Earhart mystery. We have the answer. And we said so. We had a lot of press. We did a big press conference at the National Press Club where I announced that the Earhart mystery had been solved, and that didn't turn out quite the way.
We did talk about that.
Yeah, we talked about how that went. Did get us a lot of press, and we found ourselves just embroiled in tons of controversy. But what we thought we knew at that time was that upon failing to find Howland Island, Amelia and her navigator, Fred, ran down the line of position, this 157337 line, trying to find Howland. And that was correct. We were absolutely right about that. And we figured that she must have landed on the reef and then sent radio distress calls. And then after several days, the airplane was washed into the ocean. And we were absolutely right about that. But we didn't know where that happened. And the sonar search we had done in 91 had not found anything in the ocean. So that was kind of a problem. We concluded that she must have died as a castaway on the island. And her bones were later found. And that's absolutely right. But it was all based on a rumor. It was a story that had been told by one of the locals to a Coast Guardsman who was there at the end of World War II. And we didn't know whether that was true or not. It sounded like it should be true, but that's not the same thing as having documentation.
True.
We had thought we were going to find Amelia Earhart's bones in this little grave, and it turned out to be the bones of a baby. But at that same site, we found some shoes that we decided must have been Amelia Earhart's shoes. So that was more proof in our minds. And we were wrong about that too. We thought she had salvaged a navigator's bookcase out of the airplane,
right,
and possibly a fuel tank to use to collect water in, and that a Coast Guard veteran had come across that fuel tank, and that was where the airplane had landed out on the reef and been washed into the ocean, and this stuff had been salvaged, and that was her campsite. Hmm. Well, yeah, it was her campsite, but that's not how it happened. So it's really strange to look back on that time for me now, all these years later, because in one sense, yeah, we had it figured out. But most of what we thought the evidence was wrong. And yet the basics of what happened were quite obvious. It's
from the end of your last expedition, in the time in between, you were able to identify that those things were not actually what you thought.
Well, in the time since that, since 1991, and here it is, 2021.
Right.
Yeah, we got so much more information and more details about how it actually did come about. But all those pieces of the puzzle came together over time, very slowly.
So what of those things did you actually know in 92?
The things we knew that were correct were that Earhart and Noonan had run down the line of position,
right,
and come across Gardner, now Nicomoro, and that not finding a place on land that they could put the airplane down, they landed the airplane on the reef.
Mm-hmm.
And that was right. We didn't, the only proof we had of that were the post-loss radio distress calls,
right,
that were heard, because we had that information. We knew that radio calls had been heard.
And you knew from Lockheed that they would not have been able to broadcast had she not been on land. Right?
That's right. Absolutely.
Okay, so that's...
We knew that. We knew about the radio bearings that were taken by Pan American,
mm-hmm,
that crossed down there by Gardner Island.
We
had some documentation of that. And really, that piece of the puzzle, those radio distress calls, and particularly the radio bearings from Pan American, are the smoking gun that disproves the crashed and sank at sea,
right,
theory.
Right.
We knew that very early on, and we had documentation of that. We now have much more documentation, mm-hmm, of that, much more solid proof that that's how it happened. But at that time, we had the basics of that. We did have that basic documentation.
Right.
The salvaging of material from the airplane and where this all happened and where she landed, all that is stuff that we were guessing about.
Okay.
Well, she had to land someplace. You know, well, maybe she landed over here. Maybe this is this and maybe this is that. We had a lot more work to do.
And by that point, you had found what was maybe the tank and identified that it was not the tank from her airplane?
No, we had not.
Not yet?
No.
Okay.
In 91, we looked for the tank. We searched along that whole shoreline where the Coast Guard guy said, yeah, we were walking along and we saw a place where it opened up into the interior. Usually there's a lot of really solid beachfront vegetation. You can't leave the beach because it's just a solid wall of underbrush. But he says, we were walking along and we came to a place where it was open and we went in and explored around, and that's where we saw this tank.
Oh, okay.
And some dead birds and it looked like somebody had been there. Well, we had looked for that spot in 91 and couldn't find it.
Okay.
We were determined that we wanted to find that. Because, you know, he had drawn this sketch of what he saw, and it sure looked like an Electra fuselage fuel tank. Well, okay, so the first thing that happens in September of 1992, we get our hands on some photographs that the U.S. Navy took in 1941. This is June of 41. They were surveying all of the islands. Now, this is before the war started, so this is June of 41. But then the Navy knew that things were getting tense in the Pacific, and they wanted to get a good handle on the islands that were on there. So they had a squadron of six PBY Catalina flying boats, and they did this tour around the islands of the South Pacific, and they flew over Gardner Island and landed in the lagoon. They landed. You can land an airplane here. Okay, good. And took a bunch of pictures, and we came upon those pictures in the National Archives. We said, oh, we got pictures of the island and taken in 1941. And one of the pictures is of that stretch of beach we'd been interested in, where the Coast Guardsman said, and here in 1941, there is an opening in the vegetation. Now, the Coast Guardsman was there in 1944, so it was apparently still open then.
That makes sense.
It sure wasn't open when we were there in 91.
That's a long time, though.
But it's a long time, and things grow up there quickly. But here we've got this picture that shows this opened up area. And so we blew up that picture and looked for as much detail as possible, and it's pretty grainy. They took the picture from a couple miles away, but there looks like there's some kind of structure there, like a little house or a shed or something. It wasn't a tank, but there's something there. We said, we need to get to that spot. Boy, we need to go back there, because that's a place to check out. That might be where he saw that tank. So we're excited to do that, and we had a lot of things going on in that summer of 92. We moved to a new headquarters, so we're moving. We also had moved our search for the remains of the French transatlantic attempt, the White Bird. We had shifted that search to Newfoundland, and we're working up there, and we actually found a piece of what we thought might be a piece of the White Bird in a pond up there. That was a big find, and we were looking into that. Then we were doing work in Delaware, because there were stories about a World War II plane that had bellied in, had an engine failure, and landed wheels up near Dover Air Force Base in what is now the Bombay Hook Wildlife Refuge, which is an open, marshy, tidal area. And hunters had seen this P-47 Thunderbolt fighter sitting right out there in Bombay Hook. And we thought, wow, a P-47. And we ought to go find
it. It's right up your alley. And in your backyard.
Yeah, it's kind of in our backyard. And we talked to the hunters. It was years ago that we saw it, but it's probably still right there. So I talked the Delaware State Police into giving me a ride in one of their police helicopters. And we went out there to see if we could find it. Well, we couldn't see it. We said, oh, geez. And so we decided to search on the ground, and got some...
How did that go?
Well, we found the darn thing.
You did?
Yeah, with metal detectors. But it was very corroded and sunk into the marsh. And just filthy. My stinks. And it's tidal. You can only do it at low tide. You know, working with the Dover Air Force Base Museum, Military
Certainly.
Air Transport Command
they would be
Museum,
interested.
They didn't have anything from a World War II airplane that had actually served at Dover. So they were interested in recovering whatever we could get from this old P-47.
Wow.
So working with them, we took our volunteers. It was a great way to check out new expedition volunteers.
You're not kidding.
Yeah. You try to test them on...
Was it summer when you were looking?
No, we did it in December.
Oh, my.
It was freezing cold and muddy. And
yes, and it's brackish, so nothing freezes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
And what did you do for the surface? That surface is like going from one tuft to the next. And there's
You're picking your way. And then once we excavate this hulk of an airplane sitting there, we figured that the only part we could reasonably salvage would be a section of one of the wings. That we could probably cut that off and get it back. But we had to clean it off of all this mud and muck. Right. So the folks at the museum had a pressure washer. But you gotta have power for a pressure washer. So they took a portable generator out there. We took the generator out there.
Did you set up platforms to work from?
Well, we put the generator on a platform. But then I take the pressure washer and I go over to the airplane and I'm blasting the mud off the airplane. And the wire to the generator is running through water. And I'm thinking, how smart is this? You know? But it turned out okay. And we recovered the darn thing and took it back to the museum. And then,
so was there someone in it?
No, the pilot got out okay. And they had come out and salvaged the engine and the guns at that time.
Okay, so they knew.
So this was just a hulk.
Yeah.
But what we ended up using the section of wing for was as a study for corrosion rates. And we applied different techniques to the thing to try to prevent the corrosion. And
interesting.
Eventually it all just corroded away into a white powder. But we learned a lot from it. And it was a great way to qualify some expedition volunteers.
So did the museum there end up with anything viable?
They've still got a couple of pieces.
Really?
But it was mostly in more of an academic thing.
Yeah, I was going to say that's an exercise.
So we've got all this going on, but in January of 93, we found out that there was a company in Seattle, Washington, that had negotiated with the Republic of Kiribati that owns Nicomoro for the tourism rights to the Phoenix Islands.
Oh my.
Because the fishing, especially bonefish.
Fishing?
Fishing.
Okay.
Sport fishing.
Right.
At Canton Island is supposedly really, really good. Hmm. And their plan was to have a research vessel, and they had the ship picked out. It was a RV Resolution. It was going to be a research vessel, and they were going to outfit it with sonar, and it'll be out there for research purposes because
research and fish finding.
The idea was that Kiribati was going to renovate the airfield on Canton Island because in 1941, the U.S. Army had built a really good runway on Canton. And all during World War II, it was a major refueling stop and maintenance base for the Army Air Force. And then after the war, the airlines that were servicing the Southwest Pacific, like Pan American and also the British Airways, flew through Canton, stopped there and refueled. It was a big refueling stop for the big four-engine prop jobs. It had fallen into disrepair. Nobody was using it. But Kiribati was going to renovate that airfield and have regular jet service from Hawaii to Canton Island. And then these people were going to have a ship there to do fishing and also to accommodate tourists.
Just
cabins. And it was a big plan. Well, sure, there's a perfect opportunity for us. You know, we don't have to then charter a ship that goes from Fiji or Hawaii. We can just fly into Canton and get this ship and take it just one day down to Nicomoro. And it sounded great. And we were working out a contract with these guys, and we had a departure for the NICU 3 expedition set for September 1st of 1993. And this was in January we're doing this. So by September, we're going to have this ship, and it's going to be all set. We're going to go. And, of course, this is going to be our third expedition. The first expedition was just the recovery of the Earhart airplane. We're just going to go there and find the airplane. And that didn't happen. So on the second expedition, it was the return to Nicomoraro. Well, okay, now we're going to do a third expedition. I guess this is NICU 3. And that was the first time we actually numbered an expedition. So it was NICU 3. And we're going to be there for a full month. And we're going to have, I think we had 22 people selected for an expedition team. Yeah, big gang. And we're going to go out there and we're going to search that beachfront area where there's an open place. We're going to find out if that tank is in there. And then we're going to go to that site where we found what we thought were Amelia Earhart shoes. And we're going to do a lot of detailed archaeology there. We're going to find more stuff there. And then we're going to search the beachfront where the piece of airplane skin,
right,
artifact 22V1, that we figured must have come from Earhart's airplane. We're going to search all that area. So we had big plans for NICU 3. Well, okay. It gets to April of 93, and there's enough interest in all this Earhart stuff so that the U.S. Naval Institute at the Naval Academy at Annapolis decides to hold a seminar about, well, what really happened to Amelia Earhart? You've got all these Tiger people that are saying that they've proved that she landed at Nicomoraro. And then we've got people like Tom Crouch, curator at the National Air and Space Museum of the Smithsonian. He says she probably crashed at sea. And then there are people who say she was captured by the Japanese. So let's address all that. Let's get some
people. Well, that's interesting. Did the person who organized that, was that someone you knew?
Oh, geez, how did that come about? I had written a couple articles for the Naval Institute's Proceedings and for Naval History Magazine, and I've forgotten now whose idea it was. But
interesting.
Yeah, and they invited me to suggest who might come, and I said, well, how about in addition to Tom Crouch, there's a Professor Mark Petey at Stanford University, acknowledged the leading authority on the Japanese in the Pacific before World War II. And then there was the director of the Japanese Pacific Historical Society, Hiroshi Nakajima, who we knew. He said he'd come over from Japan and be on the panel.
Wow.
And then the Naval Institute found a guy, Admiral Francis Foley, who recently retired, I don't know how recently, but he was a retired admiral who had actually flown off the USS Lexington during the Earhart search.
Really?
So here's a firsthand.
Yes.
So yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. And I was there speaking for the Nicomoraro theory. And we argued back and forth and back and forth. And before they started, they had taken a poll of the audience. We had like 300 people there. They'd taken a poll of, okay, how many of you think she crashed at sea? How many of you think she was captured? How many of the... And we fought with each other for 3 hours. And at the end, they took another poll. Nothing had changed.
Really?
Nothing had changed. Nobody had changed their mind. And I have since learned that that is very typical of these things. So, you know, take from that what you will. Around this time, we were also heavily involved in debates about aviation historic preservation. What constitutes preservation? Is it preserving an airplane to make it flyable again? Or is that rehabilitation? And should there be more emphasis on preservation? And there was a lot of back and forth about that. We put on an aviation archaeology course at the Militaire Luchtwaffe Museum in Soesterberg in the Netherlands.
Wow.
And that was a lot of fun. We had museum directors from all over Europe and several from the United States there.
So what was the customary technique at the time?
Well, most air museums just took it as a matter of course that what you do with an airplane, historic airplane that you find, is you restore it. You try to make it like it was. Huh. Repair things that are broken and polish up things that are, and repaint things. And it was also very common to take an airplane and paint it up in the colors of a famous example of that airplane. Even if this particular airplane never served in combat, oh, this is painted up just like so-and-so's, some ace's airplane.
Right.
And the Smithsonian was, Smithsonian still does that. But we held this thing at the Dutch Military Aviation Museum, Militaire Luchtvaart Museum, in Soesterberg, because they had a strict policy of preserving things as found. Now, they had a lot of really good stuff because during World War II, a lot of the action took place over what was then called the Zuider Zee. In the Netherlands, this big area on the coast. And after the war, they built dikes and dams and turned that into, they drained it into usable land. And in draining the Zuider Zee, all these airplanes appeared that had been shot down and crashed. So they're finding all kinds of stuff and recovering bodies.
That... So what year was that? How long after the war ended?
Most of the Dutch archaeological work out there was done in the 1960s.
Wow.
But they had a lot of experience with that, and they had very well-developed and articulated ethic about what you do. And you preserve it the way it was found because that's the historic object.
Was that Tiger's philosophy at the time also?
It's a philosophy we had come to believe strongly in because in our work, we constantly needed to identify artifacts. Did this come from this airplane? Was it? For example, that navigator's bookcase we had.
Right.
We wanted to know how these things were mounted in a PBY to see if this one was different. And in order to find that out, we needed to find a PBY that nobody had messed with.
Right.
Because if it's been restored, you don't know for sure whether it's been changed. Because people change things during restorations all the time. And it was just...
Well, especially if they're going to try to fly it.
Well, if you're going to fly it, you have to change things.
Right.
You change the brakes. You put new engines on it. You put better instruments in it. You do all kinds of stuff. So we found it was really hard to find original, unrestored, but preserved aircraft. And we started lobbying for that, preaching for that. And the people in the Netherlands were totally with us.
So that's how we always operated.
And we actually made some significant progress in the way aviation museums handle things.
That's fascinating. That makes complete sense.
And we're pretty proud of that. We were busy doing that. We also had another interesting project going on at the time. We called it Operation Sepulcher. There were repeated stories from American servicemen that served in Germany after World War II and had once been German airfields, Luftwaffe airfields. And it seems like all those guys had stories about, you know, you'd go in the hangar and that floor sounded hollow underneath. You know, it's all, they had underground hangars under there. And there were doors in the hillside and roads leading up to them, and there are these underground hangars where there might be perfectly preserved ME-109s and well, Joker's 88s.
How cool that would be, but what made, what made them think they were hangars and not fallout shelters or something?
Because there were stories about underground hangars. Well, German veterans told stories. So we said, well, somebody needs to look into this. Is there anything to this? And we started to do research and collect these stories and ended up going to Germany, going to these places, and looking at the original archives, getting original documents in German, and then going to the places and seeing, is there anything here? And what we ultimately found out is, yes, there had been underground hangars built. But at the end of the war, those had been either cleaned out or destroyed.
Oh. Yeah,
there were no undiscovered hangars that we could find any evidence of. And there weren't nearly as many underground hangars as people thought there were, because what happened in the last couple of years of the war is staff members would present ideas at staff meetings. For example, there was a plan that was called Pilze für Jäger. This is mushrooms for fighters. And the plan was you dig a big hole and you fill it in with like pea gravel and you make a big mound on the top of it. And then you put concrete over that mound so that you've got this big domed shelter. And then you go in and you excavate out the pea gravel.
Oh.
And you've got this underground hangar for fighters, Jaeger. Pilze für Jäger, mushrooms for fighters.
Wow.
And this is
so
plans.
These were German army built things.
Yeah,
plans,
well,
anyway.
This would probably be built by the people who built things under Albert Speer, the head of construction. And these would be elaborate plans that were presented at very high level staff meetings. Goering would say, yes, yes, this is what we want to do. And the Führer would say, yes, yes, definitely do that. And Speer would say, okay, good. And Speer knew damn well they didn't have the money to do it. It was just to make everybody feel good. Oh, we're going to do that. And it never got done.
Wow.
But we learned all these things. And we would go to these towns and we'd look, oh my God, there is this doorway in this hillside. What is this really? Well, actually, it's where the county stores their snowblowing equipment. So, you know,
was it always, or did they had they been excavated?
No, they weren't that old, really.
Oh gosh, that's
just
too funny.
But time and time again. But for me, it was very strange to go to places and meet people and talk to people. Places that my father had bombed.
Wow.
During the war.
Right.
Kassel, Stuttgart, Regensburg. So we were doing that.
Wow.
Operation Sepulcher. It was a lot of fun, but we didn't find any airplanes.
Mm.
The next thing that happened was the whole deal on the ship to be based at Captain Island. That whole thing fell through.
Oh.
Yeah. It,
what about the... What about the airfield there that had been...
Yeah, then nobody did anything to the airfield. Nothing got done.
Oh.
That, a lot of talk, but no airfield renovation and no ship. But we're still doing research on the stuff we'd found, that metal paddle,
right.
Airplane skin. We took it to a recently retired FAA accident investigator analyst, metals analyst. He had been the lead investigator on Pan Am 747 that crashed in Lockerbie, Scotland.
Ah.
So he knew all about these things. And we showed him this thing and said, how did this thing end up looking the way it does? Because it's kind of bowed out and it's got failures on different sides. And he said, well, this thing was hit on its interior surface by a strong fluid force that caused it to bend and probably blew it out of whatever airplane it was in. And so that's, oh, well, okay. That kind of supports our theory that the airplane was parked on the reef
Right.
And was hit by waves and washed out to sea. Well, this got blown up. So we, oh, okay, that. He said, but this thing was never in an explosion, because if there were explosions, you'd find these little marks on the inside.
Oh, fascinating.
So he gave us a lot of interesting information about that. Mm-hmm. So we're still doing everything we can to investigate the artifacts we have and get as much information as we can. But we got to find another boat.
Seems to be an underlying theme.
There aren't a lot of boats that can do what we need a boat to do.
Right.
To cover the distance and accommodate the passengers and support the expedition. We found out about a boat that was being refitted down in Louisiana. It was the Salmon Seeker. 180-foot boat, could take 28 passengers, and it was supposedly being refitted and would be ready by the spring. Of course, we'd need to move it from Louisiana to this Pacific, which is going to be... And so we rescheduled the expedition. We said, all right, this will be the culminating expedition of the Earhart Project, okay? NICU 3, and it's going to sail, now we're going to say it's going to sail in the spring of 1995. Okay, good. Well, by June of 94, the whole Salmon Seeker thing had fallen apart. The refit wasn't... We actually went down and looked at the boat, and we said, no, this is not going to work. But Earhart is still becoming more and more really popular. There were more Japanese capture books that came out, and we would review those in our journal, Tiger Tracks, and talk about why they were not right. There was a TV movie that came out with Diane Keaton.
Really?
That about Earhart and her
in
last...
In the mid-90s?
They actually used a Lockheed Electra 12, not a Model 10, the smaller version, the Electra Junior.
Yeah.
And of course,
what happened to her? Did they crash at sea?
She crashed at sea. Okay. Yeah, she crashed at sea. Around this time, Tiger is also becoming computerized. We got our first Macintosh computers. And it was the dawn of the internet.
Right.
A website. We had a bulletin board. It used to be these bulletin boards. And we're finding our way with all this. There was a lot going on. In May of 95, we made an announcement. We said, I'm reading from a Tiger Tracks journal that we published in May of 95. We have set for ourselves the goal of ending the Amelia Earhart mystery by July 2nd, 1997, the 60th anniversary of her disappearance.
Ah.
We're going to return to Nicomoraro in 1996 to find and recover additional components of the Electra, as well as other artifacts and, if possible, human remains.
That's ambitious.
And then we're going to perform the post-expedition analytical work, write the reports, get impartial expert endorsements, prepare the press releases, and produce the videotapes necessary to truly end the mystery once and for all by July 2nd, 1997.
How'd that go?
You can't do that. You can't just say, here's what we're going to do, because you don't know that you're going to be able to do that.
It's ambitious.
I'm sure
it creates a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah, it does. And you've got to have the enthusiasm to do it. And you've got to believe that you can do it. But it always takes longer and costs more than you think it's going to. That's just a rule. So by late 1995, we had NICU 3 set for September of 96, the next year. Mm-hmm. September of next year. We still don't have a ship. We've still got to find a ship. But we're confident we'd be able to.
And you have some time.
Well, yeah, you've got 9 months.
Yeah.
Then something happened that changed everything.
Really?
We were talking about this photograph that showed the opening in the beachfront, and there might be a structure there.
So one from 1941.
From 1941.
Yeah.
And we had gotten some press about that. It was in the news. I get a phone call from a guy in Champaign, Illinois. His name is Jeff Glickman, and he has a company called Photek. And he's an expert in what's called forensic imaging. Getting information out of old photographs. And he's a real expert in that. And he says, I'd like to take a look at that picture and see what I can see. I said, sure, knock yourself out. Yeah, okay. Glickman looks at the photograph and he says, well, I don't know about this thing you think is a structure. I can't be sure about that because they're just... I'm right down to the film grain, and there's just not enough information there. But I can tell you this, there's something back in the underbrush, back in the trees in there, that's giving us a specular reflection, and that means it's metal.
Wow.
Wait a minute, you're telling me there's a metal object big enough to cause a reflection that you can see in a photograph taken 2 miles away? It says, look, there's something there.
Wow.
And it's
so
metal.
He had equipment that could analyze the...
Jeff employs algorithms and techniques to pull out the detail without enhancing. Everybody talks about enhancing photograph. You don't want to enhance a photo because enhancing means adding stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't want to add anything. But you want to see more of what really is there.
Wow.
And he said, what I can tell you is that you've got a metal object back in that spot. And so we looked at that. We said, okay, if that's a fuel tank from the Electra, that means the plane was landed right there on the reef near that area. And so now we know where the plane is, and if that turns out to be a fuel tank for the Electra, we've got an artifact that can only be from the Earhart airplane. What do we do about this? Because if the aircraft is really there, and we've got this fuel tank there, it would be imperative that the September expedition that we have planned go equipped with both the clearances and the assets required to physically recover the airplane. Because you can't go and find the Earhart airplane and come back and say, yeah, we found it, it's right over there.
Oh.
Because then people are going to be all over that thing because there's this perception it'd be worth a whole ton of money. Public disclosure of the airplane's existence and location would present an unacceptable security risk.
Right.
So we decided the responsible course of action would be to keep our mouth shut, not tell anybody about this, and just find a way to fund a small, short expedition to go see if that's what we've got.
Oh, wow.
It's going to be a black expedition, okay? Which was really kind of cool.
Yeah,
okay, we're going to go black. So we were able to find a sponsor who would put up the money to charter a smaller boat than we would normally use for an expedition for a shorter trip. So it was less money. I think the whole thing was about $50,000. Huh. And we were going to go out. And he was going to come along.
Oh,
he gets to come along for this one.
Well.
So,
sure.
So we put together a small team, or there's seven of us,
mm-hmm.
all veterans except the sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we've got our Kiribati representative.
Right.
The same guy we had on the 91 trip.
Really?
Manika Teotabo. Yeah, great guy. And we chartered, it's a 82-foot vessel based out of Tabayuni in Fiji. It was MV Matangi Princess II. And on January 29th, 1996, we embarked for Nikumararo on not Niku 3, because we've already told everybody that Niku 3 is going to be this big public expedition. So this is going to be something else. But Next time, let's talk about what happened.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
At the end of the last episode, it was January 29th, 1996, and you had just set off from Fiji on a secret expedition to Nikumaroro.
That's right. It's a secret expedition, a black operation. We don't like to do that. We like to be very public and transparent with what we do. But occasions sometimes arise when, for the sake of the security of the site, we have to do things quietly. This was the first time such a situation arose. We had a photograph that showed where we had reason to believe there was this tank that had been seen by a Coast Guardsman during World War II, and the sketch he made of the tank that he saw looked like a Lockheed Electra fuel tank. But we didn't know exactly where that tank was. We had tried to find it in 1991, but were not able to. We searched and searched, and we couldn't find it. It was very frustrating. But then, in 1995, we got a photograph taken by the U.S. Navy, aerial photograph taken in 1991, that showed the site that fit the Coast Guardsman description.
Taken in 1991?
41. Yeah, it's a Navy photograph that was taken in 1941, but we only got our hands on it in 1995. It had what looked like to us possibly a structure there, like a little shed or a house or something.
And did it match more or less where the Coast Guardman said?
Well, it did match the area where he said he was, and there was this opening in the beachfront vegetation that matched. So I wanted to get some expert opinions on, was this a structure there or what? We connected with a guy by the name of Jeff Glickman, had a company named Fotech, and he was an expert in forensic imaging, that is, pulling out the details in photographs. Glickman used algorithms and techniques that pulled more detail out of a photograph than might be visible to the naked eye. I asked him to take a look at this photo and give us his opinion about whether there was a man-made structure there in 1941. And he said, well, there's not enough detail to tell you whether that's just an oddly shaped bush or whether it's actually a shed of some kind. But I can tell you this, that back further back in among the trees, there is an object that's giving me a specular reflection, and that means it's metal. There's a metal object back in there that's shining. And we said, whoa, well, that's gotta be this tank the guy's talking about. So now we have an exact location for that tank. And if the tank is a Lockheed Electra fuel tank, it means that the airplane was landed on the reef near there so that that tank could be salvaged out of it. So now maybe we know where the airplane is in the water, and we have an artifact from the airplane that's got to be from the Earhart Electra, and we can't just go there like we planned to do on our planned Niku 3 expedition and just say, oh, yep, here it is, the airplane's right here, and then leave. We've got to be able to recover the aircraft when we find it. Otherwise, if we just come home and say, yeah, we found the Earhart aircraft, it's right over there, people will be all over it because there's this perception that it's worth a lot of money and so forth. If this is the big find, if this is the Holy Grail we're looking at, we've got to confirm that quietly. So we need a small, short, secret expedition. So we charter a small ship out of Fiji, and we set off. It was, like we said, January 29th of 96. We had a small team. There were seven of us. All of us were veterans of previous expeditions, except the sponsor of the whole thing. He was a wealthy guy that put up the money, and he wanted to go along. And okay, fine. And we had our Kiribati customs representative, that's a requirement. Same guy that was with us in 91, Monica Teotabo, great guy. We were going to have 3 days just 3 days on Nicomoraro. It's the wrong time of year. You know, you don't go out to the Phoenix Group during what's the winter in the Northern Hemisphere. Because it's in the Southern Hemisphere, where Nicomoraro is, winter is the equivalent of hurricane season here. That's when you get the tropical cyclones, just like a hurricane. So it was not the advisable time to go out there, but we were going to hurry and it'll be all right.
And the boat crew didn't mind?
They said, yeah, whatever.
Take a charter anytime?
I guess they needed the business. So we set off. We did find out there was one problem with the boat. Matangi Princess II, great boat. It's a motor vessel, not a sailing vessel. And it's 85 feet long. Now that's a nice size boat. But Pacific swells are about 100 feet between swells. So an 85 foot boat doesn't span the swell.
So
it goes up one hill and down the backside, and then up the next hill and down the backside. And for Pat and me, our cabins were on the top deck. And the higher you are off the waterline, the more moment there is, more motion there is.
Right.
And, we didn't have any storms, but it was rough. It's always rough out there on that trip from Fiji, 1,000 miles up to Nicomoraro. You'd be in your bunk at night, and first you're pressed into the bunk, 1.5 G's, and then you go over the top, and then you're practically weightless coming down the other side. It's like a roller coaster.
Could you sleep?
You get used to it, sort of. But people do tend to get seasick.
Yes,
about
I can imagine.
That. And we had this one guy. He was the guy who was going to be shooting video for us, and. He was getting seasick, and he shows up one morning, and his eyes are all bloodshot. I mean, they're like, really bloodshot? And I said, did you fall or hurt yourself? No, it's fine. No, I need to know what happened, because anytime a team member has a physical issue, I've got to know about it. He says, well, I was just really sick, and I think I was like barfing so hard that the blood vessels in my eyes bled.
Oh, no.
He's, like, he's there over the head.
Yeah.
Just. I said, well, you've set a new standard for being seasick. You're not really seasick until your eyes bleed.
That's horrible.
So we arrived at Nikku on February 2nd.
So how many days did you spend on the water like that?
It's about 4.5 days.
Yeah. Oh.
So we're there on February 2nd, and it was late in the day. We did manage to get a small boat, the Zodiac, into the lagoon. You have to walk it through the main passage and around into the lagoon. And on the 3rd, we motored down the lagoon to the southeast end of the island, where we went ashore to start the search for the tank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finding that exact spot that showed up in the aerial photo was
like
challenging.
55 years later.
Yeah. The photo is an oblique shot. It's not a straight overhead looking down shot. So you're trying to say, okay, so it looks like it may be back in here somewhere. Remember that this area, although at that time in 1937 and up through 1941, it was open forest. Mm-hmm. The trees with little underbrush around under them. That's why the tank is shining through.
Oh, right.
But later that forest got logged off for wood by the people who came and settled there. When you do that, when you take off the trees, what grows back up on Nicomoraro is this stuff called Scevola frutescens. It's a dense underbrush, nasty stuff.
I remember you talking before about hacking through it.
Hacking through it. I mean, it's a wall, just a wall.
Mm.
You take you 10 minutes to go 10 feet. You can't see, you can't move. This is the area we have to search for this tank. So we laid out a physical grid, 20 meter squares, with brightly colored surveyor's tape. Yeah, orange or pink or something, right. Brightly colored. But you've got to hack your way through and you tie it off and you measure. And so when we got through with that, we had this grid, physical grid with visible borders. And then we proceeded to search each one of those blocks, every box. And we found the tank.
How long did that take to get to that point? Sounds tedious.
I think we'd been working for, after we got the grid laid out, we'd probably been working for a couple of hours.
Okay.
When, say, wait a minute, there's something over here. Oh, that's got to be it. And we get over there to where it is. And yep, it's a tank. But it's not an electrofuel tank.
Oh.
It's steel. It's not
not a plane part at all.
It's not the shape of a fuselage fuel tank either. It's square. It's just like other tanks we had seen up in the abandoned village used as water collectors. And it even said on the side of it, you can barely make out the lettering, it said Police Tarawa. It had been brought down from Tarawa in the Gilberts. But there were these old wooden poles laying on the ground, because the guy had said that there had been a pole at each corner with a tarp set up to drain water into the tank. Well, okay, that fits. But in the bottom of the tank, there were six half coconuts that, like, somebody had been using them for cups to drink out of something. And nearby, probably 10 meters away, there was a depression in the ground. And we couldn't figure out what that meant. I mean, look, somebody must have tried to dig a well and given up. It was definitely a hole somebody had started, and there was stuff piled up. They had partially dug it and left it. Okay, is there anything else around here? So we started really clearing out the area with machetes and stuff so we can see something. And just enough to make our way around and see something. And we came across an old food can. It was a little can that had once contained some kind of, looked like some kind of food. The label, of course, long gone.
Right.
We later figured out exactly what it was, but
really,
that came later. It later turned out that was a can of Australian roast mutton.
How did you figure that
bone-in roast mutton. It's a unique size and shape can. It's kind of like the can that canned tuna fish comes in now, but it's bigger. It's taller. And we got our hands on an old paper label from a can of roast mutton, bone in for flavor, it said. The dimensions were such that, it would fit exactly on this thing. And on a later expedition, we actually found the little pieces of bone that had been in with the mutton.
You're kidding.
Yeah, that really freaked us out for a while, because we're finding these little pieces of bone, and of course we're finding other bone there, fish bone, turtle bone, bird bones, but these don't look like that. What the heck are these things? And we got them home, got them tested. They're sheep bones. There weren't any sheep on the Camaro. What the hell? And now, wait a minute, the food can? That's what's going on here. But in 1996, we had no idea. All we knew was we had this little old rusted can there. Now, we still don't know where that can came from.
But you can imagine.
Did Earhart and Noonan have a can of roast mutton with them that they picked up when they were in Australia and had it as emergency rations aboard the airplane? Or more likely, that this is something that one of the settlers later had and just took it along for lunch or something. Anyway, there was a can. There was some copper screening. There was a piece of finished wood. So somebody has built something down here. there's a sheet of asbestos. Something was like insulated from something. There was a little button. Just a little button. All this was kind of strange.
Were they fairly concentrated?
Concentrated within an area of a few hundred square feet.
Oh, okay. And you found these within the grids you had?
Well, yeah. It was within one of the grids. After we had found the tank,
right.
We were just clearing out the underbrush in the area to see what else was there. This struck us as all very strange, but there was nothing that we were finding that suggested a castaway or Amelia Earhart or anything. And we filmed the whole thing when we were through. Just filmed me going through, saying, over here we found this, and here's what we found here, and that's nice to have. But it wasn't what we had hoped it was at all. So the next day, we decided to search the area back up in the abandoned village where we had found the piece of airplane skin, this panel of aluminum in 1991, to see if maybe there was more there that we had missed. But there wasn't. We found nothing more up there. Then we searched around where we had found this thing that we called a dado, an assembly from the interior of an aircraft. In searching that area, we did find some coax cable. It was insulated coaxial cable, but it had aviation-type connectors on the end of it. And that was interesting. And this coax cable was not found near the island radio shack, which was interesting, too. But you expect to see, well, maybe radio equipment, you expect to find it at the radio shack. But this wasn't. This was down by what had been the carpenter's shop. And then we decided to search more around the village in the time we had left. And, of course, this is all coconut jungle. And it's very different from the scavola-dense stuff that we found down where the tank was. Where the village had been, that had all been cleared out and planted to coconuts, which had grown up during the time the settlers were there. Right. But then when everybody left, that coconut planting had naturalized, new plants had grown up, the coconuts had fallen and taken root and grown up. And so it was just a jungle of coconuts, not nearly as dense as the Scavola areas, but very difficult to move around because you've got all these old coconuts laying on the ground. It's like the ground's covered with bowling balls.
Yeah.
And it's
what
very...
What kind of shoes were you all wearing? Like boots?
Like hiking boots.
Yeah,
hiking boots. It didn't help that it's down in those rotted coconut shells, hollowed out areas, where coconut crabs live.
Oh.
So you'd be walking along and you might break through shin deep down into, and there's a big old coconut crab in there.
Were they aggressive?
No, they're not aggressive. They're
just scary.
They can be kind of territorial,
yeah.
But they're not aggressive. The other thing is every place in that coconut jungle, every piece of vegetation was connected to every other piece of vegetation with a little spider web. It's just solid, and they're little teeny spiders. And you're making your way through there, and you've just got to clear the spider webs out of the way. And so what we do is cut off a palm frond or something and wave it in front of you to knock down the spider web. So we look like some kind of religious procession going through the jungle.
But good thinking.
But try as you might, you end up with little spiders all over you. And they're hanging down off your hat brim, and you just learn to ignore it. There were house sites there. Now, the houses that the settlers had were all made of natural materials, so those were all rotted away. But they were supported by rounds of logs, little stumps that were cut and put at each corner. And that's how you could tell that it was a house site. And so we're curious about the house sites because that's where people did things like cut up pieces of airplane debris, airplane aluminum to use for fishing lures and to make combs and stuff. We knew because we'd found these artifacts. So we're searching for more of that kind of thing, and we're finding more little pieces of aluminum that had been cut up. And at one point, at one house, I'm looking for stuff. Ah, there's no aluminum here. There's just some, that's like glass or something. And one of the guys was Beryl Fendelson, dairy farmer from Minnesota. He says, "Is that glass? That's plexiglass." Wait a minute. Plexiglass? And we pick it up, and it's about the size of a deck of playing cards, a shard of plexiglass that had obviously been cut to use pieces of it for some purpose. Hmm. But it had a distinct curvature to it. It wasn't just a flat piece. So this is interesting.
Yes.
Plexiglass is not something I would expect to find in a Gilbertese village in the middle of nowhere.
And were they using plexiglass at the time in aviation?
Yeah, they were.
Manufacture, huh.
And it turned out that this artifact, after we got home, we found out it was very interesting. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we found other bits and pieces of aluminum. And we left the island the next day. That was February 5th. Headed home. 5 days later, February 10th, we're back home. Say, well, we made a big deal of this thing, special trip, secret, because we thought we were going to find the airplane, or well, we might find the airplane. But we struck out. We're back to square one. We don't know where the airplane landed. We don't know where the airplane might be now. We don't know where the bones were found, if the bones were found at all. That's just a story that was told. It seems to be true. There was supposed to be shoes found, and we found a shoe that we think is Earhart's. Is that the shoe? We don't know. But now we've got to explain this expedition. We're not going to keep this secret. I mean, there's no reason to. So in the March 1996, the next month, issue of Tiger Tracks, our journal, we described what we called NICU 3 preliminary expedition. We couldn't call it NICU 3, so this is NICU 3 preliminary. And the way I described it was, the expedition succeeded in locating and identifying the features seen in the aerial photographs. Ta-da! It was found that the objects in this particular location are not associated with the Earhart disappearance. Some searching also was done in the remains of the abandoned settlement on the atoll's west end. As on the two preceding expeditions, a number of interesting artifacts were found in this area, and, with the permission of the Kiribati government representative, several artifacts were recovered for analysis.
Run all those by them one at a time and make sure it was okay to take?
We had an agreement with Kiribati that we could collect anything we thought was interesting, with the understanding that it still belongs to Kiribati. Mm. We're just stewards, and we can analyze it and do whatever testing needs to be done. But they control its ultimate disposition. And I've got hundreds of pieces of stuff that we found on that island. A very small number of them, I think, are almost certainly from the Earhart aircraft, but most of them aren't.
Hmm.
Yeah, I've got quite a junk collection, but some of this stuff is really very significant. So at the end of the expedition, we still had more questions than answers, but the artifact research was looking good. That piece of plexiglass we talked about,
Turns
out the thickness, the curvature, the type of material, everything about it matches Lockheed part number 40552. That's the cabin windows of a Lockheed Electra airplane.
Really?
Yeah. Not the special windows that Earhart had installed. She had two standard windows in the cabin of her airplane. And part number 40552 are those standard windows. Mm-hmm. And we got the original engineering drawings and compared the curvature, the thickness, the material. Perfect match. To be doubly sure, the New England Air Museum had the windows from an Electra that they were restoring, and they had decided to replace the windows as part of the restoration, And they loaned one of the original windows to us. For comparison. And, yep, exactly. But we also checked to see, well, World War II airplanes, bombers, and even fighters had canopies and all kinds of windows and turrets that had plexiglass. Do any of those match? We did a lot of research and couldn't find anything that came close.
Oh, that's interesting.
The stuff in those airplanes was either thinner plexiglass for just a window, or most often much thicker, like for a gun turret. You'd have a much thicker and much more sharply curved piece of plexi. That looked promising. It was encouraging. And the outlook for the Big Niku 3 expedition was looking pretty good too. We had identified and contracted with a new ship, 120-foot motor sailer that worked in Fiji as a liveaboard dive boat.
Oh.
It was owned by American expatriates out of Hawaii. They lived in Fiji and they had this ship they called Naya, which is Hawaiian for dolphin.
Ah.
And as a motor sailor, the main means of propulsion was an engine, but it did have a big sail that gave it, and a deep keel that gave it stability. It was 120 feet long, so it's longer than a Pacific swell, and much better ride. And they could accommodate up to 18 passengers, and they were set up to accommodate divers. It was a perfect ship for us.
Yes.
Perfect
how,
ship.
How did you make that connection?
The captain of Matangi Princess, the ship we used on the 96 trip, was Carol Dunlop. And Carol also did some work for Naya.
Oh.
And she said, we had talked to her about, well, for this next expedition, we need a bigger ship. Oh, you ought to check with Naya. Naya's great ship.
Great. You continued to use Naya.
Well, we ended up using Naya for 5 expeditions. Naya was our ship. On only one occasion did we use a ship other than Naya, and that was when we needed a much, much larger ship to do a sonar and ROV search. But that came later. So we had found the right ship. We found a time when they were available. It was in January of 97, the next year. And again, it's the wrong time of year to be out there.
Is that why they were available?
Yeah. But hey, we had gone out there in 96 without a big problem. So, you know, what could possibly go wrong?
Oh, don't ask that question.
Well, that's a question we'll answer in the next episode.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rick.
Thanks for listening. The Earhart Expeditions is a serial history of Tiger's 12 expeditions to the South Pacific. We release a new episode each Tuesday. You can receive special bonus episodes and get access to Tiger's extensive video library by becoming a premium subscriber. Just go to Patreon, that's Patreon, and search on Tiger, Tiger. You can also be a part of the adventure and participate in research. Go to tiger.org and click on Join Tiger. See you next Tuesday.